Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, U.S. Indian law for Native Americans has been remarkably inconsistent in its recognition of tribal treaty rights. But a recent case, McGirt versus Oklahoma, seems to recognize the importance of upholding the treaties. A new book discusses these issues, looks at the implications of the case, and puts it in historical and legal context. Doug Becker interviews the authors.
I'm Doug Becker. In 2020, the Supreme Court surprised many observers by holding up the rights of the Muscogee Creek Nation. In McGirt versus Oklahoma, the court held that the Creek Nation retained its sovereign rights over a very large part of eastern Oklahoma. The decision began with a poetic line: "At the end of the Trail of Tears is a promise." The case raises further interest in issues of Indian law, which includes a very important case on this year's docket on the issue of adoption of Indian children without the consent of the tribe. Robert Miller and Robbie Etheridge have written a new book on the McGirt case, on the history of the Muscogee Nation's relations with the United States, and case precedents and the details of the case itself. And the title of the book references that first line of the Supreme Court's decision. It's called "A Promise Kept: The Muscogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma." And our guests today are the authors of this book. Robert J. Miller is professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He is interim chief justice at Pascua Yaqui Tribe Court of Appeals and is an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. And Robbie Etheridge is professor emeritus of anthropology in the Department of History at the University of Mississippi. And she is the founding editor of the journal Native South. Thank you both very much for joining us. And Robert Miller, we'll start with you. This book is about the McGirt versus Oklahoma case. What was decided in that case?
In McGirt versus Oklahoma, the United States Supreme Court held that the Muscogee Creek Nation reservation from 1866 had never been disestablished. And so instead of the tribe owning just perhaps 100,000 acres is what I've calculated, the tribe's reservation now encompassed 3.25 million acres of land. And the relevance of this was that the state has no criminal jurisdiction over an Indian who commits a crime on an Indian reservation. So the conviction of Mr. McGirt in Oklahoma state courts was held to be invalid in the McGirt decision in July of 2020.
And for this case, and actually very consistent with a court who seems to be extremely interested in history, extremely interested in issues like, you know, original intents and drawing from this history, it's almost impossible to speak of this case without speaking of the history of the Muscogee Creek Nation and their relationship with the government, with the federal government of the United States and with the states. So Robbie Etheridge, a lot of the book goes into these details about the relationship between the tribes and the federal government. Would you characterize that relationship as primarily contentious? Or when we think of this in our history books, there seems to be quite a bit of violence between the tribes and the U.S.
I have to agree with that. It was very contentious pretty much from the birth of America. And the contention was over land. And that contention starts actually with colonization, even before the founding of America. But once the United States was established, the dream of manifest destiny sort of surfaced almost immediately. And you had also a lot of the American economy at the time was being fueled by land speculators and banking interest in acquiring land, and for various reasons, for agriculture, for natural resource extraction, whatnot. And at the time the United States was founded, almost the entire United States was held and occupied by Native peoples. So that contest over land starts, America was kind of founded in the crux of that context. And that contest continues to today, with McGirt being an obvious example of that. Those issues of land have always been, I think, central to the relationship between the Native peoples and and the U.S. federal government.
Could I just add, Robbie's absolutely 100% correct. Thomas Jefferson wrote private letters in 1803 with the idea, he said, all Indians will have to move west of the Mississippi one day. So he was thinking as early as 1803 about removal. George Washington had written about that to the Congress, giving advice to Congress in 1783. There's a very interesting book by someone that worked at the Smithsonian for 20 years or more about how the third, fourth, and fifth president of the United States were driven by or ordered around by the Southern planters because they needed more land. Mm-hmm. So Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe were literally the slaves, this book says, or the servants of the Southern planters.
If you look at the early history of the United States, if you go to the congressional records, for example, one of the main things that they discuss constantly is the so-called Indian problem. And the Indian problem was that Indians occupied most of the United States, and they wanted, you know, Americans wanted that land. And, you know, there's a recent book by Colin Calloway on George Washington and his involvement in land speculation. So many of these founding figures of ours were also big land speculators. They had, you know, economic and vested interests, as well as a sort of a national goal of acquiring these lands. And so it was always fraught and contentious. And Native people, I mean, they were quite aware of the larger context of the pressures for them to cede lands, to get lands. And then when removal started being talked about as early as, you know, in the early 19th century, 30 years before it actually occurred, they were very well aware of these conversations going on. So Native people were feeling the pressure instantly.
And Doug, Thomas Jefferson wrote in his private diary, I forget the exact year, but he said he had balanced the federal budget on the Indian land sales. So again, what Robbie said, these profits, this grasping, greedy idea of getting Indian lands into the hands of Americans was federal policy for a couple hundred years.
And Robbie, there were two issues that stood out when thinking about, you know, what was driving this relationship. I mean, obviously the desire for land. I mean, two areas that I was not very aware of until I read this book was, first of all, literally the planting practices, what they were growing, and how much the tribes themselves were kind of teaching the Southern plantations, you know, how to use some of that land. And then the other is how this becomes intertwined with the issue of slavery. So I'll start with the first question. The crops themselves seem to drive this need, this desire for land in a way that I think a lot of contemporary history books kind of leave out that story. So could you talk about that?
In the pre-cotton days, although cotton was always grown in the South, but the early days of the South in the colonial era, it was mostly grown along the coastal region. But cotton, you know, was even then a very valuable commodity. And so, you know, agriculturalists and whatnot were very interested in improving the varieties so that they could grow it in soils beyond just the coastal soils. And once that variety gets developed, which is the late 18th century, and then you have the cotton gin being invented, but you know, it's still very slave dependent. I mean, cotton was a very slave dependent agricultural product, and so it went hand in hand with slavery. They needed that labor, and honestly, you could not grow cotton and pay laborers and make any profit. So slavery and cotton were tied together in many, many ways. And then as these varieties get adopted and cotton starts to move west, and it moves into what we call the cotton belt, or sometimes called the black belt. And in fact, that area of the American South was actually a fairly narrow swath through the American South. And much of that cotton belt was Creek country at the time. Creeks owned that land, and they too were also practicing cotton agriculture. Now, not on the scale that some of the Southern planters were, but by this point, you've got some Creek men and women who are becoming interested in becoming cotton planters and turning, you know, and doing a commercial agriculture, moving from some subsistence agriculture to commercial agriculture. So Native peoples, and not just the Creeks, this is throughout the South, they too start adopting chattel slavery and cotton and whatnot. Now, at the time, of course, all this gets truncated for the Creeks and other Southern Indians with Indian removal. Once cotton comes in, the Southern planters, as Bob mentioned, just start agitating and lobbying the federal government heavily for Indian removal because they wanted those land. They wanted those land for cotton production. And I should also add that cotton production needs auxiliary production, you know, horses and cattle and grains and all this other stuff to feed that industry. And those auxiliary productions took up the other parts of the South that weren't actually, you know, so involved in cotton growing. So the whole of the South gets involved in this. And so Indian nations well beyond the Creeks, as we know, you know, the five tribes get removed altogether, but in the South. So it becomes, you know, a big land grab, basically.
And Robert, the federal government is very much supporting this. I mean, you were talking about the early presidents and this recognition of a need for Indian removal, but profiting, you know, from this. So, I mean, there's both an economic and a political motivation for Washington to be behind Indian removal as well. And, you know, part of this describes this, that we think of Andrew Jackson as the one that drives Indian removal. But the book points out that, I mean, he may have been a culmination of a policy, but he certainly didn't invent it, correct?
Oh, absolutely correct. I mean, when Europeans came to this continent, what'd they want? They expected free land. They thought they could own it, grow whatever, make money off it. As Robbie mentioned, George Washington was a land speculator. Thomas Jefferson's father was. Jefferson had interests in the West. Most of these the richer aristocracy of the early America was looking to the West, and they just thought these were empty lands that they could take. So what this was a balance of power. Until the United States became more powerful, it could not just drive these tribes out. And so what we call the Indian removal era of federal Indian policy is actually the second era. And it's deemed to have been started in 1830 when Congress passed the Removal Act. So that's when Congress was strong enough to do it, and some tribes were rounded up like the Cherokee and driven practically at the point of a bayonet to the West. My own tribe was removed from South Central Ohio in 1832. So we were part of this removal era of federal Indian policy. But you are exactly correct that Andrew Jackson is the one that was the president at the time. So most Americans see that it was Jackson, but it was around by Jefferson and Washington and the Congress and the aristocrats long before that.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing a new book, A Promise Kept, The Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma, with the authors Robert Miller of Arizona State University and Robbie Etheridge of the University of Mississippi. And so, Robbie, with this, another aspect of this history that I found really fascinating was your description, the book's description of the way in which slavery, guns, weaponry all get intertwined. There's always this assumption that, well, there was just so much more power coming from Washington, so much more power coming from European settlers that the tribes didn't stand a chance. But it was really much more complex than that, wasn't it?
Yes. And that's one thing that I sort of I talk about a lot in when I was teaching and in my other works is that it's easy to think of Native peoples as being the victims and just being rolled over, you know, by these colonists. But in fact, you have, I mean, the contest continues today. And as Bob said, you know, the power differentials shift and change over time. So in the early years, early colonial years, it's really clear that Native people hold the balance of power, you know. And then that shifts over time, right? That shifts. So by the 19th century, at least in the, well, I would say in the East and the West, the balance of power has shifted so much that now America is ascending and Native power is starting to wane in terms of, you know, economic power, military power, and just plain demographics. Native peoples had suffered much in terms of, you know, early demographic losses from early Indian slave trade and obviously disease, and also these incessant wars that were characterized almost, you know, 400 years of life after colonialism. So demography of Native populations in America had declined, and we don't have a real good sense of that, you know, but the estimates are a 90% population loss in, you know, between contact and, say, Indian removal. So, and on the other side of this, you have this influx of Euro-Americans and Africans you know, just swarming into the country. So just in economic power, military power, and just sheer demographics, I think, like I said, make that the changing power differentials by the 19th century, at least in the South, the Southern Indians, you know, they're still not victims though. If you read the book, you see they fought to, I mean, they did everything they knew what to do, and every avenue open to them, they took to fight removal. And once they got in Oklahoma, to rebuild their nations. And to this day, they still do that. So the resiliency and the determination, especially the Creeks, but I would have to say most Indian nations, to preserve their autonomy and their sovereignty has been just incredible in the face of, in against all odds in some cases.
Yeah. And just quickly to add, by the way, to the demographic question, Daniel Immerwahr's How to Hide in the Empire also highlights, I mean, what you described with respect to emigration, but also just birth rates in the U.S. I mean, kind of describes the whole manifest destiny movement as being, at least in part, just a spread out because it was just such a huge population strain on the coasts. So there's both the economic and the demographic, you know, components. But Robert, also about this question about resilience and resistance. I mean, you made the reference to your own you know, tribe being driven out of, you know, Ohio, and what's pretty famous case of resistance and military defeat. That really does mark a great deal of the removal. This really is violence and forced removal, correct? Oh.
Absolutely. One of the famous Shawnee leaders that my mother says I'm related to, Tecumseh, fought with the British in the War of 1812 because the enemy were the Americans. By that time, the English were mostly good trading partners, the Hudson's Bay Company, etc. But it was the Americans that were doing what Robbie just said, taking land, letting their animals run onto native lands, eating native crops that they were growing of corn, etc. And a native could do nothing practically to resist. But I also want to back up a point that Robbie just made. When these tribes and the Muscogee Creek Nation in particular, when they finally agreed to remove to what came to be called the Indian Territory and what is part today, half of Oklahoma, these tribes signed treaties with the United States and insisted upon receiving the fee simple absolute title to their lands in the West. So we're getting a little bit into law here. The fee simple title is the way you and I own our home under English law, where the, like, lord and master, we're the absolute owner of our properties. And the tribes did not want the United States to have any right in their land. They didn't want Americans to have any rights. And these treaties that the five tribes from the South signed all said that they would never again be under state law or under federal territorial law. Well, the United States violated those two promises in every one of those treaties, but it did show what Robbie said, the resistance, and what you just asked me about. And we could even call this legal resistance then, as they tried to use the law to protect their lands in the West.
Again, agree with this use of the American law. But after removal is when I think there's a real increase in that. I mean, you know, Native peoples and Native leaders were very savvy, smart. And they knew what they were up against, and they used the American legal system and, you know, to win their cases. And they received, I mean, they received, the Creeks received the land patent. It's 1852. They were the actual owners of this land. And, you know, it wasn't that the United States gave them this land. It wasn't anything like that. They owned this land. This was guaranteed to them in exchange for the lands that they were leaving in the Southeast. From that moment, the federal government, and then especially when Oklahoma becomes a state, Oklahomans and Americans begin trying to chip away at those treaties. And what's so interesting to me is that despite all the efforts for almost 150 years to chip away at those treaties that they held, right? And they still, to me, the McGirt case says they still hold today. So, you know, those treaties were between sovereign nations, and they weren't just, you know, something that went away when, you know, America decided they didn't want to deal with Indians anymore. No, these treaties were binding agreements, right? Even though, again, many, many efforts over many, many decades to chip away at those, but they held, which is, you know, kind of astonishing, really, but also, I think, kind of a I have to say, kind of a nice, you know, means that we are, in fact, a nation of law.
Well, the Constitution in Article 6 says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And that's why, you know, my wife woke me up the morning the McGirt decision came out and she said, I think the tribe won that case. And so that very first sentence, Doug, that you've already read me showed we the tribe had won that case. At the end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. Well, the promise was that treaty that is the supreme law of the land under Article 6 of our Constitution. And as Robbie just said, it can't just be disregarded or thrown away once it had served the purposes of the United States and the land grabbers, land speculators, et cetera.
And Bob, one of the things that I find fascinating about all of the case law and how the history fits into this is frequently Indian law gets framed as a civil rights question. The rights of the tribes, the rights of natives, you know, for full protection under the Constitution. But this book, and of course, the McGirt case itself highlights that this is that Indian law is completely unique compared to civil rights questions, that really we shouldn't be thinking of this as civil rights, because that makes the assumption that the tribes are actually part of the United States and not sovereign territories. Is that really one of the key takeaways from all of this, is that this is actually perhaps more international law than it is, you know, American law, of course, the Constitution playing a key role.
Well, I'm delighted with your question, because absolutely, Indians were not citizens of the United States then. The tribes were sometimes on the borders of the United States. Sometimes they were inside states like the five tribes in the South, but they were not part of the states and their land was not part of the state. The state had no authority to rule over tribal lands and still is not supposed to today. So it is a unique situation. The Supreme Court has said, and I believe this is a quote, the relationship between the United States and the Indian nations is an anomalous and unique situation. So in the whole world, yes, it's unique. And if you are correct, it's not proper to talk, or not even legally correct, to talk about Indian rights as some kind of civil rights because of being a racial or ethnic group. That's not right. It's citizens of different governments and the powers those governments have.
And then historically, Robbie, it seems like a couple of key takeaways from the book is that the tribes themselves wanted to be recognized as sovereign entities. They resisted removal, but once they were removed, insisted that they be properly compensated. Take my land from here, and if you're going to move me someplace else, I own that land. And that there's been quite a resistance, really, from Plymouth Rock to, you know, 2023, that the tribes, you know, have wanted this form of resistance, is this demand of a recognition that we are a unique nation. Yeah. Historically, that seems to describe this, right?
I agree completely. Yes. Let me back up a little bit. You know, in the early colonial years, these Indian so-called nations were forming, partly in response to these outside pressures. But by the 19th century, I think that the idea of a nationhood, the idea of a peoplehood existed, certainly for the Creeks and most other tribes as well. So, you know, they understood themselves to be a people, a sovereign people, you know, separate from the United States. And they did, and you know, this was an international affair. This was not a national affair. This is an international affair, the removal era. Now, of course, what happens is that, the United States, the federal government, again, pressure from economic sectors, pressure from land speculators, pressure from, at this point, some other industries such as fur and coal industries that are developing, you know, they start pushing for acquiring those lands. And you know, famously, Creek people, as well as other Native people, declared that all lands were communally owned. In other words, this was national territories that could not be sold to other nations, right? It would be like as if Japan came over and bought my house and suddenly said, oh, well, now, you know, Japan owns part of America. That's not how it works, right? And so the Creeks and others said this is communal property. And of course, the United States came in and with the Allotment Act. And this was very devastating to Native peoples, because this was a way to try to break up those communal land holdings. And it succeeded in, you know, giving lands to particular people, you know, in private land ownership to families. But again, it's like in the United States, I own my property, but I'm, you know, the still part of the United States. I am not a, you know, so with the Creeks, it was the same way, right? You may have private ownership of your land to do with as you wish, but it's still communal land. It's still part of the Creek reservation. It's still part of the Creek territorial base of the Creek Nation.
Doug, let me follow up a point that Robbie's making. She's bringing up this Allotment Act, in which Congress again tried to destroy Indian country by breaking the reservations into small parcels of lands to be owned by individual Indians. This has caused problems that continue to exist today for tribal governments and reservations in governance, criminal law, civil law, etc. But this is a very interesting point that Justice Gorsuch emphasized strongly in his McGirt opinion. About the Creek Allotment Act, Congress sent a Dawes Commission, it's called, to the Creeks to try to get them to sell their reservation in eastern Oklahoma, I believe in 1883. And that commission reports back to Congress that the Creek will not sell one single acre of land. So just what Robbie said, the tribe knew it was their land. They owned it in fee simple absolute, as I mentioned earlier, and they were not going to allow the United States to remove them again. And so Congress is told, we can't buy this land, so what should we do? And so Congress says, well, let's allot the land. So Gorsuch relies on this as pretty strong proof that Congress never thought the Creek reservation borders were being diminished, but that it just chose to allot it into these small privately owned pieces that Robbie just mentioned.
In fact, when I was preparing for this, I went back and reread the opinion of McGirt, and the dissent, again, they try to use the Allotment Act as saying that this was a way to disestablish the reservation. And the Dawes Act, the intent of the Dawes Act probably was to do that, but it didn't succeed. And the Creeks, and not just the Creeks, but others, held out against that very thing. Like they saw that that's what the Dawes Act intended, and they resisted and held out against that. So, you know, if you read the Dawes Act, if you go through and look at the consequences of the Dawes Act, In no uncertain terms, I think Judge Gorsuch was absolutely correct in using that as a cornerstone of the McGirt opinion, because there's no way that Dawes Act, and in fact, if you read the Dawes Commission reports, they say many times the Creeks refused to sell their land. The Creeks refused to cede any lands to the United States. It's very, very clear that did not happen with the Dawes Act. The allotment, anyway, that went on for years, but it never happened with allotment.
And the Supreme Court has stated at least three times that the Allotment Act did not affect the borders of a reservation, did not make it smaller. We call that diminishment of Indian country, or disestablishment is when a reservation is completely erased. So the Supreme Court has long stated that allotment did neither of those things. So the dissent in McGirt, as Robbie just said, relies on the Allotment Act, and they're ignoring their own case law for decades.
When we return, we're going to ask, how much is McGirt a break or is consistent with U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and what this means for the relationship between the U.S. federal government and the tribes going forward, as well as, you know, what has it meant really for the last 100 years of jurisprudence, of law, and of practice. So please stay tuned.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Was McGirt versus Oklahoma consistent with case precedent in U.S. Indian law? Doug Becker explores.
We're discussing a new book that examines the McGirt versus Oklahoma case, the case about the relationship between the Muscogee Creek Nation and broadly of the tribes and the federal government, what constitutes sovereign territory, and some broad implications on who has jurisdiction over crimes that have been allegedly committed, and a number of other key issues of what we broadly call Indian law. Our guests today are Robert Miller. He's professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University, and Robbie Etheridge. She's the professor emeritus of anthropology in the Department of History at the University of Mississippi, and they are the authors of the book, A Promise Kept, The Muscogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. So, Robert, as I was preparing for this, I was wrestling with a question. I know there was a surprise that the tribes won in McGirt versus Oklahoma. But was the decision consistent with the cases that the Supreme Court, you know, have heard? I mean, in the book, you pointed out two or three cases a year on Indian law. So there's a lot of case precedent for this. Was McGirt pretty consistent with the case precedent, or is it a break in its recognition of Indian sovereignty?
I think McGirt applies the tests that the United States Supreme Court's been developing since 1962 about how to decide if a reservation has been made smaller, we call that diminishment, or if it has been completely gone out of existence, we call that disestablishment. The reason the case was was a surprise, Doug, is because the Supreme Court has been pretty much anti-Indian, it's fair to say. The statistics prove very clearly that since Justice Scalia joined the court in the fall of 1986 and William Rehnquist became the Chief Justice in 1986, tribes lost 80% of their cases. Now, that contrasts with the previous Berger court, in which tribes won 58% of their cases. So something happened, Doug. I don't think all the Indian law attorneys became bad attorneys. So it's the makeup of the court, the very thing we're talking about today. So the thing that was surprising about McGirt was that a court that was pretty conservative, and now you have Justice Gorsuch appointed by President Trump, are the tribes going to win cases? Under the Roberts Court, since fall of 2005, the tribes been losing about 90% of their cases. All of a sudden, Justice Gorsuch is on the court. The tribes win something like six of the next six cases. So McGirt was not a surprise based on precedent and the Supreme Court test, but a surprise based on the makeup of the court and the history since 1986 of our losing record in the Supremes.
Now, you mentioned Justice Gorsuch. I want to follow this up. I mean, he's been described as a strict textualist. And it seems like, at least from what I've read, I don't have the legal, you know, education, but what I've read is that in many ways, he's deciding these cases because he's basically reading the text and saying, I mean, this is a treaty, this is a text, this is what the Constitution says, and is holding pretty consistently to the specific text. And so therefore, it's not that he's necessarily supportive of the rights of the tribes. It's just he's recognizing that the legal precedent here is the treaty itself and that those need to be enforced. So is that a signal that maybe the court has taken a turn much more in favor of Indian rights?
Well, the textualism that you brought up and originalism is what the conservative wing of the court says they all are now. Justice Elena Kagan said a few years ago, we are all textualists now, and she's one of the liberal members of the court. So yes, what you described is exactly how I understand it. Read the text, just word for word, don't consider anything else, and just apply the text what it means. An originalist is someone who thinks, well, what did the founding fathers think when they wrote this sentence in the Constitution? Or what did Congress in 1910 think when it passed this 1910 law? So the dissenters in McGirt, and I write in the book, they should have joined Justice Gorsuch and they should have upheld this treaty. If they truly believe that they, in textualism, the language of the treaty, and originalism, what the United States and the tribe thought at the time they signed these treaties in 1866, then the dissenters should have joined the opinion to enforce the decision. But they went way beyond text. They went way beyond what happened in 1866. And they took into account the illegal actions of Oklahoma for the past 107 years. And the dissenters said the reservation is long gone. It was a 5-4 decision, Doug. So we have to be, you know, one justice made the difference. So, yes, the tribe won the case, but the narrowness of the victory is scary for future Supreme Court cases when these alleged textualists and these alleged originalists were willing to look at what Oklahoma had done in the 100 years since, which everyone knows was illegal.
And Robbie, you had mentioned prior to the break, Dawes actions, Dawes commissions, Dawes Act. I want to kind of drill down on this. First of all, what exactly was the Dawes Act? What was it trying to accomplish? And in what ways did it infringe upon tribal rights?
The Dawes Act was an act designed to undermine national territories of Indian nations, basically. And the idea was that they would, because like I said, almost all Indian nations, I think all of them, in fact, held that lands were held in common. So they were all communally held, their national territories, and that you were granted, if you needed to farm or have, you know, your cattle on a piece of Indian property, you had use rights to it. So you could, you know, you were granted rights to use it as you needed to. And then when your use ran out, when you no longer needed it, it was always tribal lands. It never was your land in private property. So you could never alienate it. You could never get, you know, sell it. Well, with the Dawes Act, the idea was we are going to break up these communal lands and we're going to divide them into certain lots of certain acreage. And we're going to give these to families, you know, as private property so that these families could now do whatever they wanted to with their land. It was, you know, private property. They could buy or sell. They could sell their lands if they wanted to. The idea was that then white speculators and white people or Americans with vested interest in these lands would come in and buy the lands from Native folks. That was kind of the idea. And then also because Native people held so much land in common, the idea was that, and their populations were relatively small, right? I mean, relatively, they still had thousands of people. But that once you allot the lands in these, you know, lots, there's going to be a lot of land left over because not all of it's going to be used by these families. So there'd be a lot of land that would be surplus lands that could then be either the United States would come in and purchase that land from the tribes, or that land would be open to American settlement. So again, the idea was to assimilate Native people into America as you know, private landowners. These lots weren't large. I mean, these were 160 at the largest, and then they, you know, went to 80 to 40. So they weren't huge expanses of land. But that surplus land was. There's a lot of surplus land. So that was the idea, was to take, it was a way to acquire Indian lands for Americans, to open Indian lands to American settlement, basically. I think the flaw in the Dawes Act was, I think, engineered to, yes, I think maybe even to disestablish the reservations. I don't know that they used that language when they were conceiving of the law, of the act, but what they failed to recognize was that they were dealing with sovereign nations, right? That, like I said, yeah, you can't just come in and have an American come in and buy a piece of Indian property and say, oh, now it's America. It doesn't work like that with a sovereign nation, right? Like I said, Japan can't come and buy my house and suddenly say, oh, now Japan's got a foothold in America. It doesn't work like that. Right. If I sell my land, I may sell it to a Japanese person or Japanese industry or whatever. But it's not Japan. It's still America. It's the same thing with these other Indian sovereign nations. It was the same. And so the Dawes Act, to me, whatever the intent, what they failed to recognize in that Dawes Act was that they're dealing with sovereign nations. And Indian people exploited that when they started to resist. Right. And to you know, insist that they are not, this is Indian lands, this is Indian territory, which they do to this day, right? It was, what happened though, is that it did create enormous amounts of chaos and lots of court cases of people coming in and trying to swindle Native peoples, Americans and others coming in and trying to swindle Native people out of their land lots. And a lot of pressure for Indian peoples to sell their lands to Americans, tremendous pressure. A lot of those land claims went to, this is where you kind of get back into the law. They ended up in the court systems. Now you had tribal, federal, and then once Oklahoma was established as a state courts. And this is where, and these contests over these land claims and allotments and, you know, and whatnot. So, you know, just end up in the court system, which becomes just mired in just this quagmire of contesting claims and one ruling this way and one ruling that way. And most of those rulings were not in the favor of the, you know, Indian owners of the land. It just became a huge, huge mess. And again, I think still trying to sort it out, obviously, to this day.
And Robert, and the McGirt case at its core is really a jurisdictional case, right? Well, you've got these different court systems. You got the federal system, you got the state system, you got the tribal courts themselves, and this competition over who has the right, you know, to hear a case. That's the core of the McGirt case, and that's been a pretty consistent battle in the cases throughout the 20th century, right?
Absolutely. So we really haven't gotten to McGirt, but Mr. McGirt was a heinous criminal who is Native. He committed a crime against a Native child in what we now find out is the Muscogee Creek Reservation, because the reservation borders were never changed since 1866. And so what you just said about jurisdiction, Oklahoma has no criminal jurisdiction over an Indian who commits a crime in Indian country. Now, that's a legal term of art. It's defined in 18 U.S.C. section 1151. That's the federal code, the federal statute. 1948, Congress passed this law to define clearly what Indian country is. And so this case is about, where did Mr. McGirt commit his crime? Does the Muscogee Creek Reservation from 1866, do the borders still exist? And if they do, Oklahoma has no criminal jurisdiction over McGirt. So this case was only about criminal jurisdiction, yes. And Oklahoma has made this argument ever since then that it shouldn't have any impact on civil issues and adjudicatory court jurisdiction or environmental laws or child custody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But once an area is Indian country, the whole panoply of tribal and federal laws for Indians and for Indian country now apply. And that's what Oklahoma has lost its mind about. And the governor has been going on since the case came out. He just can't get over this. He rants about this all the time, and they have been fighting back against the McGirt decision since the day it was decided.
Are there some specific acts that the governor has tried to take? I know he's been giving a lot of speeches, but have there been legislation passed to try to undercut it?
Yes, he got the Oklahoma legislature to appropriate $10 million right quickly to hire outside law firms to fight McGirt. He, at the state of Oklahoma, filed over 45 petitions of certiorari, they are called. That's when you ask the Supreme Court to do something. No one in the history of time has asked the Supreme Court the same thing 45 times. They've asked the court to reverse McGirt more than 45 times. That's sanctionable conduct by an attorney to do such a thing, to tell you the truth. The Supremes have denied that every single time. So McGirt continues to be the law today, but the challenges are just barely beginning, Doug. Our chapter 8 is, we attempt to guess what the consequences of McGirt are. In my first article on my McGirt, I called the case a bombshell. I really think this just shocked people. I think the governor is shocked and can't get over it. So the challenges over taxation, there was a case just decided this past October. There was a case about surface mining regulation in Indian country that Oklahoma claimed it still had, and Oklahoma lost November the 9th, 2022. And so the lobbying, the legislation, the litigation is going to go on for decades, I think.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book, A Promise Kept, The Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt v. Oklahoma, with its authors, Robert Miller of Arizona State University and Robbie Etheridge of the University of Mississippi. So with that in mind, it seems like, and Robbie, you referenced this when you talked about the Dawes Act, that a lot of this has to do with the tribe itself, tribal rights, the idea of, you know, communal ownership, et cetera, versus trying to take each individual member of the tribe and let that individual member, whether they, you know, sell their land and diminish the tribal lands, or even, you know, broadly, you know, take this, what ultimately is a, you know, sovereign treaty rights, and make them about civil rights. So it's fair to say that's, I'll kind of invent a word. Is that kind of a Dawesification of all this, trying to take all of the rights of the tribe itself and make them about the individual rights of the members of the reservation, or the members of the tribe, excuse me, rather than about the tribal rights themselves?
I'd probably go that far, you know, because these individual rights are a matter of jurisdiction. You know, who has jurisdiction? The tribe have jurisdiction to over the rights of their citizens, or does the federal government, or do the state? And that's kind of, you know, like you said, that's part of the heart of the McGirt case, of who has jurisdiction. And so individual rights for Native peoples are tied, because they are citizens of three different entities. They're American citizens, they're state citizens, and they're tribal citizens. And, you know, so it's a really complicated question of where do their rights lie? You know, who has the authority to give or take away rights of individuals? Who has that authority? And that's part of the morass that's Indian law, is it does overlap with, you know, at least three different entities: the state, the tribe, and the federal government. Now, by treaty, for the Creeks, and I suspect many of the other tribes, the federal government has jurisdiction in Indian country. But in the 20th, and Bob can talk about this more than me, but certainly especially the late 20th century, more and more of that jurisdictions were given back to the tribes, right? So, criminal cases, different kinds of particular cases, a lot of that stuff was reinstated back to the tribes, and tribal courts and tribal jurisdictions were reinvigorated. They never went away, but they were kind of reinvigorated in the late 20th century. So jurisdiction and civil rights, I think, are interconnected. And so that, again, that becomes at the heart of the McGirt case as well. As you said, some of the cases coming up.
Yeah, because immediately what's on my mind, Bob, is the rights of the tribes to have any say over the adoption of children. This case, the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA case, being framed by so many as, you know, this is a civil rights question about the rights of the children themselves, but the tribes are asserting this has much more to do with tribal rights and ultimately kind of a jurisdictional question about the nature of adoption. So does the McGirt ruling say anything broadly about that case, the one that we're all watching and eagerly, or maybe not so eagerly, anticipating the ruling at some point at the end of the docket?
Well, you're referring to the Brackeen case that the Supreme Court heard oral argument on, I think, November the 9th, 2 hours of oral argument, which is unusual right there because of the importance of this case. And it is about the Indian Child Welfare Act. Robbie and I write a little bit. So we try in Chapter 8, we try to guess the consequences and the future issues, jurisdiction largely, that were going to occur between the United States, the Muskogee Creek Nation, and the state of Oklahoma. One thing we've also haven't said, Doug, is that because of McGirt, Oklahoma state courts have now re-recognized the reservation of 8 other tribes. 43% of Oklahoma is now Indian country, and 1.8 million Oklahomans live inside a reservation now. 90% of them are not Indian peoples. So this is why I call it a bombshell. There's lots of changes that are going to occur. There's lots of issues that have to be handled. Justice Gorsuch and the majority hoped this would be handled by negotiations and by compacts, by agreements between the nations, between Oklahoma, the tribal nations, and the United States on tax, on child welfare, on criminal jurisdiction, court jurisdiction, traffic tickets, everything you can think of, zoning, just everything. But now we have this dispute about the Brackeen case coming in front of the Supreme Court. And I've now almost forgotten your question, but we're worried that maybe, I guess we were talking about group rights over individual rights, the rights of tribal nations to govern themselves, to manage their lands, even if an individual Indian owns land inside a reservation, like Robbie was saying, the tribe is the government with jurisdiction and authority over them. Just as you and I own a house in Arizona. Yes, I own it in fee simple. But the state of Arizona has lots of power over me, how I use that house, et cetera. So does New Mexico have power over me, the United States, or Arizona? That's pretty much what the question is here, because the Constitution recognizes Indian nations as governments. And so I'm slightly walking back to the Indian Child Welfare Act. Congress passed that law in 1978. And Robbie and I opine in the book how there would be conflicts between Oklahoma and the tribes now that the reservations were so large. So the Brackeen case is not from Oklahoma, so let's not confuse it with McGirt, but it's an example of states fighting the federal government and fighting tribes when tribal powers are exercised. Everyone's jealous of their own sovereignty and their own jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court could issue opinion any day now. Maybe they don't issue a Brackeen decision till the end of June, which is when they usually hand out the hard cases. But we don't know what the Supremes are going to do. I mentioned the tribal losing record in front of the Justice Roberts Court. And we'll see what Gorsuch does. And there's, of course, now one more conservative on the court than there was when McGirt was decided, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. And I don't really even want to opine on what's going to happen, but I had a long discussion with other Indian law professors just last night on this Brackeen case that you've brought up.
So one final question then. The title of the book is A Promise Kept. How much has the McGirt case suggested that these promises, in fact, can be kept? Because so much of our history books suggest treaties were signed, treaties were abrogated, you know, promises were made, and then the federal government acted in ways that undermined those promises. And when the McGirt case came out, a lot of us, myself included, knew very little about this law and very little about, you know, just the nature of Indian law. But there's a lot more interest in these cases, and perhaps, you know, there's the judicial case, but also the political case, where people who are not members of tribes say, at a minimum, we need to uphold the treaties that we've signed and those obligations. Do you have confidence that voters could have something, you know, something to say about this? I'll ask Robert first and then finish with Robbie.
Well, a treaty is a contract between nations. That's what the Supreme Court said about an Indian treaty case in 1979. So just like a contract, Doug, if you signed it 10 years ago and you don't like it so much today, you still have to comply with it. If you breach it, you have to pay damages, you get sued, etc. So the United States signed these treaties maybe back in 1866, but according to the Constitution, they're the supreme law of the land. They have to be complied with. And if the United States wants to take a reservation from a tribe, they have to pay for it. They're breaking their own promise. They're breaking their own treaty. They're breaking the law and their constitutional sovereign relationship with Indian nations. So I think the public can understand that very well. You buy a house, you keep it for 30 years, you pay your payments, and then you own it free and clear. You stop paying your payments, they take your house back. So if we... That's exactly why the Supremes compared the treaty to contracts, so we could understand how we interpret Indian treaties and why we still enforce it even 150 years later.
Robbie, we have about 60 seconds. Are you confident that we're moving in a positive direction here?
I'm confident that the tribes will keep us moving in a good direction. you know, as the history of Indian relations with the federal government and state governments show, it's been a very contentious, difficult relationship. And occasionally, on many occasions, you know, the American governments have and state governments have pushed things in a way that helps the tribes. I really think that it's the tribes that have done most of the hard work on this, and I do not see them letting up on this. And they know the system well enough to know how to work to make that system work for them.
Mm. The narrative of the relationship between the U.S. government, state governments, and the tribes themselves has been a narrative of resistance on the part of the tribes. And maybe the best way to view this is legal resistance continuing, very consistent with the historic resistance that the tribes, the historic resistance the tribes have been committed to throughout these conflicts. The title of the book is A Promise Kept, the Muskogee Creek Nation and McGirt versus Oklahoma. The authors are Robert Miller, professor of law at Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He is interim chief justice at Passamaquoddy Tribe Court of Appeals and an enrolled citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. And Robbie Etheridge, professor emeritus of anthropology in the Department of History at the University of Mississippi. And she is the founding editor of the journal Native South. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.